when you understand money and fiat currencies and the ill side effects of debasement and inflation and how billions of people suffer from that and the second order effects of that on society, you realize that bringing sound money to the world, digital sound money, can have an outsized impact on things and actually change the world. And that just completely captivated me. And I just thought Bitcoin was the coolest thing that I've ever come across.
You're listening to Because of Bitcoin, a podcast that shares the personal stories of how Bitcoin is having a real impact in people's lives, including mine. I'm your host, Mauricio Di Bartolomeo, the co-founder and CSO of Ledin. And without further ado, let's get started with today's story. In less than 6 years, Bitcoin treasury companies have grown to become an asset class that's over $80 billion today. And last week, TD Cowen formalized what many of us already knew, officially designating public Bitcoin treasury companies, or PBTCs as they called them, as a distinct and investable equity category. We've seen a massive proliferation of these companies, and thanks to the recent price action in Bitcoin, many of these companies' stocks are now trading at prices below their Bitcoin's net asset value. So what will define the winners going forward? How will the financing models for these companies evolve? And where are the most compelling opportunities being built right now, whether inside or outside the US? These are the questions we'll be going through today with Sam Callahan. He is the director of Bitcoin strategy at Orange BTC, the largest Bitcoin treasury company in Latin America. Sam is also a good friend and one of the sharpest minds and researchers in the Bitcoin space. I really enjoyed this chat and came out of it feeling very bullish about Latin America and, of course, about Bitcoin. I hope you enjoy our chat with Sam. Sam, how are you, man?
Hey, Mau. It's good to see you.
Likewise. Great to see you again. And I've been really excited to chat with you. Well, I don't want to get right into it right away, but the space you're in right now is a fascinating space. And we can talk a lot about what's been happening there in terms of treasury companies. Before I start the show, I want to ask you the same question I ask everybody that comes on the show, which is, what was it like growing up in the Callahan family? And was finance a big topic at your dinner table?
Ooh, at the dinner table, I would say no, actually. We had a pretty big family, and I think my parents instilled in me that, you know, money is important, but it's not the most important. So my parents always wanted us to just do things that made the world a better place, that helped people. They're more spiritual. They're not very materialistic. And so like money wasn't really discussed that much at the table. You know, we were always, you know, we weren't like extremely wealthy, but we also didn't need for anything. So I knew that, you know, I was privileged in many ways like that, where they provided for us and gave us a pretty good quality of life growing up in the United States. And so we were middle class and really grateful for the childhood that we had. But, you know, in terms of the conversations around money, I would say that when I was in high school, I started to really kind of think through investing. And my dad managed his own money. And that was actually a consequence of years and years ago, he had trusted a financial advisor. And he didn't like what he did. He kind of thought that he was put into more risky things that underperformed less risky things. And eventually he fired him or her. I don't really remember, but he instilled in me the importance of managing your own money, you know, trusting yourself as opposed to trusting other people. And then he also instilled in me a big distrust for banks, central banks. I think you can call my dad a gold bug back in the day. And so he taught me the history of finance, the history of money, the history of central banking through his own mistrust, because he was very well educated on that stuff. So when the global financial crisis happened in 2008, my dad was all over that. And he kind of understood what was happening when a lot of people were, I think, confused through the jargon. and all that stuff. And so that's what my dad provided for me when it comes to money was, I think, and my both my parents, I guess, but it was one, that there are more important things than money. Two, trust yourself with your own finances. You know, have responsibility. Don't trust somebody else. Be knowledgeable and take, manage risk the way that you see fit and for your own financial goals. And also distrust of the current financial institutions and the current financial system. I got that from my dad as well. So he pointed me to some books like The Fourth Turning, some Rothbard, and a lot of books about Austrian economics that I actually didn't open up until after I found Bitcoin. But if I had, I would have loved it. But I should have listened to my dad earlier. And so that was the Callahan family. And then I really kind of, once I discovered Bitcoin, I really, really took off with that whole topic of money, well, obviously.
It sounds like you were being bred, or not bred, but you were being raised as a Bitcoiner. I mean, a lot of the values that you mentioned, right? Like personal accountability, distrust, like, you know, doing things for yourself. It seems like your dad was a Bitcoiner before Bitcoin existed. Like, I'm curious, are they Bitcoin fans? Like, do they understand what you do? I'm always very curious.
Yeah, you know, I would call my dad pretty conservative though. And so it took him a long time to pull the trigger when it came to Bitcoin after me annoying him over and over and over again for like 5 years. And so I did get him in, and I think he finally picked up a book and read a little bit about it. And he, you know, he's a baby boomer. He's not the most technologically advanced, I would say. You know, he likes going for walks. And so the whole digital nature of Bitcoin, I think, kind of scared him off and for a while. But then once he really started to understand why it's unique, why it's not just like vaporware that's going nowhere, that it's actually a, you know, breakthrough technology, and it solves a lot of these problems that exist with gold and other physical assets, I would say. That's when he was like, okay, I get this. And so it took a while, even for my own dad, you know, even if I worked in it, for him to pull the trigger. And it's really related to volatility and risk management. And, you know, he's just more of a conservative guy. But then once he wrapped his head around Bitcoin and understood that in a lot of ways, Bitcoin is conservative. And actually, it's interesting because of the risks you eliminate when you allocate to it. That's when it, I think it really clicked to him that actually this is kind of like a safe haven asset. And so as a retiree, he's like all in on that. And so now he owns it, he holds it, and he lets time and compounding do its thing, which is what a lot of people should do, I think.
Yeah, like the Warren Buffett quote, even though he didn't get Bitcoin right at all, he got right this idea that the most money he made was it was actually sitting on his hands doing nothing. You just
totally
buy the right thing and just let your thesis play out. At what point do you find, I mean, you've had a very long career in Bitcoin, and we're going to get to that and what you're doing now. But before that, what was that moment? Like, when did you decide to go all in and build a career on Bitcoin?
Oh man, I think Bitcoin just spoke to me on so many levels. I think the things that attracted to me, I think going back to what I said about my parents, like I actually felt like Bitcoin was this unique situation where it presented a lot of opportunity and a lot of upside, asymmetric upside, you know, personally number go up technology, of course, but it was this rare opportunity where you could do that while also making the world a better place. And when you understand money and fiat currencies and the ill side effects of debasement and inflation and how billions of people suffer from that and the second order effects of that on society, you realize that bringing sound money to the world, digital sound money, can have an outsized impact on things and actually change the world. And that just completely captivated me. And I just thought Bitcoin was the coolest thing that I've ever come across. And so I fell down really hard down the rabbit hole almost immediately because of, like I said, the education from my family, understanding the traditional financial system and monetary system and the problems with it allowed me to really grasp the solution right away. And I didn't really have somebody who orange-pilled me. It was more my prior, I kind of geeked out on financial history and central banking. I really dug deep into the global financial crisis in 2008, tried to understand it the best. I was reading like the transcripts from the hearings of like Neil Kashkari about how they allocated the TARP. Like you can go find these. These are like very deep, like long, long, boring looking court documents. But I was like reading those. And so I understood Bitcoin almost immediately. You know, and I guess nobody really truly understands Bitcoin fully, but I kind of understood the value proposition. And I was like, this could actually work. You know, this kind of solves some of the problems that plagued gold, which was the reason why fiat currencies came about in the first place. And it kind of stops this extractive system that favors people over others. And it creates a more fair system, more equitable system. And like I said, the second order consequences of that is why it was so intriguing to me. And so there was always like a humanitarian angle to why I decided to work full time. Like Alex Gladstein's work really resonated with me. And it's how I was thinking about things too, of why I wanted to dedicate my life to it, because I just felt like this was a technology that could actually help a lot of people in a lot of different ways. And I still believe that to this day. And I think the world just continues to wake up to that fact.
I think, you know, I relate to a lot of what you said. I think one of the things I love the most about the business that I'm in is I get to lend money using Bitcoin as collateral, and I get to give rates that are the same to people in different parts of the world. And before that, before Bitcoin, you couldn't do that. And you couldn't do that with gold. You couldn't do that with houses. You couldn't do that with cars. And so I had once, and I remember this because it was like ingrained in my memory. We were doing, in the early days of Ledger, we were pitching to a bunch of VCs. And one VC that we met with, they passed on the investment. This was very early on. But he said to us, almost like he loved the project, the analyst that was talking to us. He loved Ledger. And he said, even though we're not going to make it into this round, he said, I want to commend you guys because I see a lot of companies all the time. And it's not... It's not always, or it's very rare to find a company that is doing well financially and offering a product that you can feel good about and selling something that you can actually feel good about and that about people using this product. Like, yes, I'm sure the betting markets or whatever these things are now, prediction markets are making a ton of money, but can you feel good about selling, effectively gambling, right? To people like it. And so I kind of really like the point that Alex Leishman made recently, being like, you know, are people putting out products that they want their families to use, or are they just putting out products that they want other people to use, right? And I think Bitcoin, anything related to Bitcoin and Bitcoin focused and centric is that family, you would get your family to use it. Maybe not like perps, right? But like most of the Bitcoin products. However, I question really whether anybody should really hold or borrow against Dogecoin, right? Like, or whether that should be offered. But anyway, I'm digressing.
Yeah, I agree. I agree with the broader point though. I mean, it's just when those things are aligned, like your value as well as the way that you, you know, create an income for yourself and your family, you know, that's the best of both worlds. And so like, you know, somebody said the best salesman is when they actually believe in the product themselves. You know, they'll sell it like crazy because they're like, well, you got, like, they're so enthusiastic, they're so passionate. You know, Bitcoin doesn't have like an official sales team, but any Bitcoiner, I think we're all part of this network and we're just trying to educate people, and we are kind of like selling the virtues of Bitcoin and why it's great. And it comes across as salesy sometimes, but it's really just because we're so passionate about it. And so it's like this thing is awesome. Like, you should really love this too. Like, it's great for all these XYZ. And so when you have that alignment, it's usually a pretty special thing. And as you get older, you realize how rare that is.
100%. I would talk to Bitcoin to my friends and my friends from my MBA, my master's. And when I was talking to them about it, they would ask like, Mao, why are you selling this so hard? I'm like, I'm not. I'm just telling you why it's so exciting, like, but to your point, it come across as you're trying to get them to buy. I'm like, no, I'm telling you why I bought it. But anyway, you've been in this space for longer than probably most of the friends I know. You have a very long career in Bitcoin. You write some phenomenal research, and I encourage everybody to go read it if they haven't yet. Today, you were working at Orange. And Orange, I would like for you to tell us what made you decide to join Orange? And what is Orange, maybe, before we go there? If you can do both in one.
Yeah, no, Orange BTC is we're the largest Bitcoin treasury company in Latin America. And so we are a Bitcoin-focused public company listed in Brazil on B3. And our mission, our broader mission, is just to bring the Bitcoin standard to Brazil and Latin America, to drive Bitcoin adoption, to improve Bitcoin access, to improve Bitcoin educational resources, to bring Bitcoin products and services to that region in a way that maybe doesn't exist yet. And I think there's a lot of incredible builders. I mean, you know, in Latin America, incredible Bitcoiners. But when you compare the market infrastructure to, say, the US, it's a little bit behind still, and which, you know, creates opportunities. And there really wasn't a public company in entire Latin America focused only on Bitcoin. And so that's what Orange BTC came about. And we think there's a lot of benefits to having a large Bitcoin treasury. You know, we're the 23rd largest public holder of Bitcoin today. And we are inspired by people like Strategy and Saylor and the team over there. We want to incorporate their business model, some of what they're doing, as well as bring about different strategies and different products and services that would fit that market really well that don't exist yet. And so crypto adoption broadly in that region is really high. Chainalysis puts out their adoption index, crypto adoption index every year. It's probably the best report of just adoption geographically. Brazil was the only one in the top five for every single category for crypto adoption. But the infrastructure just, again, is just a little bit lacking. So there's a little bit of a disconnect there in terms of adoption, as well as the products and services that are available. And the education. I was kind of surprised to see, you know, I'll share a chart that in the US, people have seen it for many years, and it's a great chart for a reason. It's been passed around, but then you translate it to Portuguese and you show it and people are like, their minds are blown. They haven't seen it yet. And so I think there's just a lot of opportunity to teach that market about why Bitcoin is valuable and to help them improve access to get Bitcoin. And that's through Bitcoin-backed securities. Orange BTC is Bitcoin-backed equity. There's different Bitcoin-backed credit products that are gaining steam and momentum. You know, we just plan to improve access and education and drive Bitcoin adoption in every way we can. So bringing back to why I got into Bitcoin, this region has suffered from instability, currency debasement, capital controls, basically mismanagement of the currencies throughout the region. And so this is a region that needs Bitcoin the most. And I think that Orange BTC is well positioned to be a leader in that region to help drive Bitcoin adoption and help them grow out of this history of currency instability and fiat currencies and move towards a future on the Bitcoin standard, on digital sound money. And so when Guy, I had worked with him before, brought up this idea, it was super enticing for all those reasons. And I just liked the idea of building in a market that really kind of needed it, but also there's a little bit of an opening in terms of competition and things like that as well for us to be well positioned. And I felt like the management team had the experience both locally in Brazil as well broadly in capital markets to actually deliver. And that's important. And I'll stop there. We can go farther into it, but I'll stop there.
Frankly, I'm a huge Orange fan. I've known Guy for a long time. I know Fernando. I've followed Fernando for a long time. I'm a huge fan of him as an educator. He's probably been the guy, you know, spearheading education in Brazil. And, you know, as a Venezuelan, you know, that was very much our thesis at Ledin. I think we were the first people to translate our services into Spanish. Because we that was actually the first target market for us was Canada. After Canada was Latin America, because we knew people needed the product there the most. And to your point, like what good is it if I gave you a new golf club and you already have 11 golf clubs like America, right? Like I look at America and portfolios, it's like here's one more club for your amazing set of golf clubs that you can hit in any direction at any conditions, right? Whereas Latin America had never played golf. They didn't even have the stick to pull, to hit the ball with, right? And so you're giving them a stick. So if you give somebody a club and they've never hit a ball, it's very different than you're giving somebody a club and they already have 11 Titleist, you know, golf clubs. Probably not the greatest analogy, but to your point, take the product. A bottle of water at Disney is not as valuable as a bottle of water in the Sahara Desert, right? And so why would you not take it to the desert if you can, right? Like it's where people are going to benefit the most. Now, you're in the Bitcoin treasury space. You guys are the biggest in LATAM. Brazil is a great market for this. I can wax poetic on why there's so many fits into what you're offering into that market. What's your current view of the Bitcoin treasury company's landscape at the moment? We had a bit of a wave and a rush, I would say, last year. Where are we now? Where would you place us now?
Look, I mean, I think we're going through a Bitcoin cycle. I think we're in a Bitcoin bear market. These Bitcoin treasury companies, the equity of them, you could think about it. Saylor calls it amplified Bitcoin. You know, typically during bull markets, if they're well structured, they should outperform. And in bear markets, they should underperform. So it's not surprising to see, you know, the equity of these companies to be underwater compared to the peaks, because Bitcoin's corrected 50% off its all-time high. And there's correlation there. I mean, they hold a lot of Bitcoin on their balance sheet. They're building around Bitcoin. We know how cyclical this entire industry is when it comes to Bitcoin price performance and equity performance. So it's not surprising. I've always thought there was a bit of conflation going on with these Bitcoin treasury companies, when really you have to look at them individual, case by case, both from a capital structure, you know, treasury operations strategies, the management team, the amount of leverage they take on. You have to really dig into the weeds. And I think what you're seeing is kind of there's a separation of the wheat from the chaff right now, where, you know, some of these companies, you know, let's take a step back for a second. You have spot Bitcoin, and the risks there are more like protocol risks, right? And you trust that, you have it in self-custody, you remove counterparty risk, you remove, you know, all the things we love about Bitcoin and self-custody. You know, there's not really a comparison there. When you purchase equity into a Bitcoin treasury company, you're shifting that risk from the protocol to the management team. And you're trusting that the management team is able to execute on their vision, on their strategies to increase their Bitcoin holdings accretively for their shareholders. And so it's a different risk profile, different return profile too. Like I said, typically they outperform in bull markets. And so if the team's executing, and so your risk has shifted from a protocol to a management team. There's nothing inherently wrong with that. It's just different. And people need to understand that. And so when you buy the equity of one treasury company versus another, they're very different. And some companies, and it's one of the reasons why I joined Orange BTC actually, was they were very conservative with the amount of leverage that they had on their balance sheet. And they actually said no to a lot of money that was trying to be offered to them, because they understood Bitcoin's volatility, and they're preparing to withstand that volatility and be a company that survives through multiple cycles to deliver on our promise, which is to drive Bitcoin adoption and improve Bitcoin access and education. And so some companies took a different approach, right? They took on maybe a little bit too much leverage, maybe the terms of the debt weren't great. And so that only shows up in periods of volatility like today, where you can kind of get into some trouble. Some companies just have different strategies, like altogether, where they're a little bit more maybe aggressive with their yield strategies, which again, you could make that Bitcoin productive, but that also comes with risk. They have different operational businesses. You know, some of them learn that having an operation business that's not related to Bitcoin, there's also risks on that side too. Some have operational businesses that are performing well. And so you're seeing this kind of difference in performance from different treasury companies. Some are selling Bitcoin, some are acquiring Bitcoin during these bear markets. I think you're seeing the business model, when you look at strategy and some of these others, they're actually buying a lot of Bitcoin during a price correction. And I think a lot of the critics were pointing at Bitcoin treasuries as some existential risk during a Bitcoin drawdown, but we're actually seeing strategy and others be almost a buyer of last resort and showing the resiliency of their model. They're not selling Bitcoin. they're accumulating more Bitcoin, and their equity continues to trade at a premium to NAV during this correction. And so I think a lot of the critics need to take note of this, because they thought that this was going to be one of the biggest drivers of a Bitcoin bear market, was the selling from these treasury. There's some of them because they made decisions that in the past that they're kind of suffering the consequences now, but there's others that are accumulating. And so that's what I mean when you say analyze these things from a case-by-case basis. So that's where we're at with the Bitcoin treasury space. I've never been more bullish on it. You know, it's still, you know, the fundamental idea of having a Bitcoin-focused public company that has, you know, access to capital, access to better terms than, say, an individual can achieve, because you have a public company that has a strong balance sheet, you know, they're able to get more favorable terms. And so that still exists. It's basically like taking advantage of the Cantillon effect, if you think about it, really, because we're closer to the money. This is just the way the game works. Don't hate the player, you know, hate the game. But when you're a public company with a strong balance sheet, lenders are more willing to lend to you at much favorable terms. That's just how it works. Now you can turn around and do whatever you want with the proceeds. Bitcoin treasury companies think that buying Bitcoin with the proceeds is the best way to allocate that capital for many, many different reasons. And so I still think that stands. It's kind of like Pierre Rochard's blog post way back in the day, right? The speculative attack.
It's funny you mentioned that. I mean, I see too many parallels with you know, this whole idea of democratizing access to Bitcoin and a lot of what we've been doing, even this idea of the speculative attack. You know, Preston Pish once called Ledin, or it's like basically I described the model to him and he goes, well, you guys are just a speculative attack company. And I thought that's great. But I agree with you. And listen, as a lender, I can totally see what you're saying in terms of the bigger you are, the better terms you can get. Like, this is the way it's always been, because a lender takes less risk. And so, I completely get your point about separating the wheat from the chaff. Like, I can see it in the data. And that was one of the things I wanted to ask you. I'm browsing through BitcoinTreasuries.net right now, which shows the sort of MNAVs and a bunch of other metrics for these companies. To your point, I think it's a big mistake to treat these things as if they are all the same and just like the different ratios are the only nuances. This happens also in every sort of Bitcoin product. Bitcoin-backed loans, people just look at the rate and they assume that everything else in the back is the same. It is not. That's actually the biggest mistake you can make. So I'm looking at this right now and I'm looking at some of these MNAVs, which, by the way, in the hype times, these MNAVs or multiples of net asset value, companies were trading at multiples of their net asset value, sometimes 3-4 times, right? And the vision was, or the view was, that these things could never get sub 1% of MNAV, because why would they? Well, who would ever do that? There would be arbitrageurs waiting, M&A running to jump on it. I'm seeing quite a bit of these companies trading below MNAV. For the record, OrangeBTC is not. You're one of the few companies that is still trading above MNAV, and I think that speaks to the quality and resilience of your strategy. But how do you think this resolves itself in terms of sub 1 MNAV? And why do you think we haven't seen more M&A activity in this space yet?
Well, there's no reason why these companies can't trade at premiums or discounts. Anybody thought that they couldn't? I think, you know, this isn't like a... The reason why ETFs are good products is they have that redemption mechanism where you keep it at NAV, but just like a closed-end fund that doesn't allow redemptions, they can trade at premium or discount. Same thing technically exists with a treasury company, except that they're operating companies. And so again, if the management team can deliver value on a Bitcoin per share basis that an individual shareholder could not, they can implement different strategies, they can launch different operational lines of business, and they execute, they should trade at a premium. Like, what is that worth? It has to be worth than the Bitcoin holdings on their balance sheet if they're delivering value to their shareholders. So it makes sense that they could trade at a premium. Now, the premium could also be a form of sentiment. So I think you had a lot of, like, that's another factor into it. And I think over the summer last year, you really saw kind of like a speculative fervor where the sentiment just kind of got really disconnected from the fundamentals with some of these premiums. I don't know if we'll ever see something as crazy as the as high as some of these premiums got over the summer. And so that's part of it. And it could work on the other side, right? So now sentiment could be in the gutter, and you can have these things trade at discount just because sentiment's low. And that could be an opportunity for people if they believe in the management team to, you know, acquire these companies trading at a discount to their Bitcoin holdings, and they believe they're going to deliver value even above their Bitcoin holdings. You know, that if you loved it at a 10, 15x premium, you should love it at a little bit of a discount. And so I think these companies are also trading at a discount or a premium for different reasons. Again, this is like case by case. You know, some of these companies might be trading at a steep discount because you're looking at the balance sheet and the capital structure, and you're just like, wow, they got a lot of leverage, which could be challenging over the next year if Bitcoin doesn't, you know, jump from here and kind of lingers or goes down from here. They could find themselves in a challenging situation where they might have to sell Bitcoin. And, you know, that's not bringing value to shareholders, right? And so they could trade at a discount for that reason, or it could just be sentiment, or it could just be liquidity. There's a lot of different reasons. But again, you have to go down and say, well, what is the long-term outlook and the vision of this management team? What's their ability to acquire more Bitcoin in a creative way for shareholders? And do they deserve to trade at a premium or a discount? That's for the market to kind of dictate. It's kind of like a multiple on a stock, right? It's just what the market gives it. And then I think, you know, in terms of your M&A question, you know, we might see some more M&A activity. I mean, there's been a couple. The problem with an M&A, in my opinion, it seems like the market has a difficult time digesting any M&A activity, any kind of acquisition or merger. It's like, is this actually accretive for shareholders? And it takes a long time to get an answer to that question. You know, it's years where you look back and you're like, wow, that was a really good decision, and the shareholders gained a ton of value from it. Years later, you could be like, that actually, we could have done something different, and that wasn't as accretive as we thought it would be. And so that's one of the reasons why Bitcoin's so powerful. When you raise capital, you can turn around and buy it. You immediately know, you know, shareholders know, like, I bought Bitcoin, they could track it immediately. Where you have an M&A transaction, you know, you just don't know for years. And so there's more of a question mark. The market has a hard time digesting, analyzing it. Is this accretive? And I think that's part of the reason why you haven't seen as much M&A activity in the Bitcoin treasury space, because there's a lot of math that goes into it. You know, what should the price be of this acquisition so it's accretive based on both share prices, based on both MNAVs? And it's hard because your other option is just turn around and buy Bitcoin. And if you could buy it at a discount, like really steep discount, like sure, I could see some more activity like that. But again, it's not as simple as like, oh, this is trading at a discount and I'm going to buy this company, as opposed to buying Bitcoin, let's say at NAV, just spot Bitcoin or whatever. You know, it's very clear. And then the last thing I'll say is that there's like integration risk. That's the other thing. That's part of the problem. It's hard to digest because there's integration risks. There's like, you have to mesh culturally and organizationally, you know, structure it. And it's just more complicated. It's just more complex. And it's very simple just to raise capital and buy Bitcoin. And so that's my take on the M&A activity. I think you could see more, but I think people simplify it.
No, that's a fair point. I think that this was sort of painted as this like very dynamic correction, self-correcting mechanism in the industry, where if the NAV went below zero quickly, arbitragers was going to buy it up, and or M&A was going to step in. But that doesn't account for the transaction fees, which you have to account for, which is very expensive to basically acquire a public company as a public company. Plus all the other things you mentioned, which I think nails it. The incentive to purchase a Bitcoin treasury company has to be multiples of spot in order for it to be worth your while. And I don't think that we're there just yet, or the incentives aren't just enough to drive some more of this M&A. Going back to your idea of, you know, this this error or misdemeanor that people make where they say, oh, it's a Bitcoin treasury company, as if they're all one and the same. And really, the only thing that changes is the ticker, which is a big mistake. In my mental model, out of the business models from treasury companies we've seen today, I generally put Bitcoin treasury companies into two different buckets. And probably there's more, but this is to my overly simplified way of looking at it. There's the Bitcoin credit distillery operation, which is basically a strategy or a Strive type of operation. They are creating digital credit instruments. They're buying Bitcoin. They don't really have an operating business, or it's a negligible operating business. Their operating business are their treasury operations, right? And then there's another sort of separate bucket, which I call the operator bucket, which is they have an operating business and they have Bitcoin on their balance sheet. So these would be examples of Metaplanet with their hotels, or Nakamoto with BTC Inc., maybe even miners, or companies like Block, right? If you play that future along, it's very clear what can happen to that second bucket. The second bucket is just an operating company that is adding Bitcoin to their balance sheet because they don't want to have a melting ice cube of cash. And presumably, under that scenario, a lot of operating companies will one day become Bitcoin treasury companies, quote unquote. But it's really just a reinforcement to their treasury. On the other side, I believe there's room to have at least one of these big Bitcoin credit distilleries for every large, you know, captive market, because these are the guys these are the types of firms that will reconstruct their yield curve, right? Like they'll have like the preferred, which is the overnight, and then they'll have like 1 year term or 2 year term, and they'll slowly. That's at least my, again, very simplistic vision of this. What is that? Does that track with the way you see the split? And how do you think these things evolve from where they are today?
Yeah, I would say, you know, firms like Strategy and Strive, they're issuers of digital credits. They're using their large Bitcoin balance sheets to deliver Bitcoin-backed credit instruments to the market that have different risk profiles, different volatility profiles, to meet investors where they are. And different investor cohorts have different desires, as well as mandates, as well as risk tolerance levels. And so just think of those firms as simply taking the raw Bitcoin and then stripping some of the volatility on it and delivering different products that fit their goals or their mandates or their risk tolerance. That's really what they're doing. And that's an operation. They're creating these, they're financial engineering these Bitcoin-backed securities. And so that is one form of a treasury company. That's an operating company that's just using their Bitcoin treasury to deliver those products to the market. And so you have that kind of cohort. Then you have, like you said, there's like companies that have almost differentiated operating businesses that aren't related to Bitcoin necessarily. And some see that as a benefit. Some see it as additional risk that kind of complicates the value proposition of the company. I go back and forth. I don't think there's anything necessarily wrong with it. At Orange BTC, I think we're trying to deliver products to the market and just has everything and services, financial Bitcoin's financial services, but Bitcoin aligned. We want everything that we're doing to be related to Bitcoin, building on Bitcoin, providing access, better access to Bitcoin, better services in that region, all around Bitcoin. And the one other cohort that you didn't mention is just the more defensive, you know, company that has nothing to do with Bitcoin, but are just adopting Bitcoin as a treasury reserve asset, as a, you know, debasement hedge or just diversification in their reserves. And so those companies exist too, like the SpaceX's or the Tesla's. So that's the last cohort that I would say. But I see kind of what you said, where the thing about being a issuer of digital credit, especially in a different market, is you need a pretty significant size balance sheet of Bitcoin to support those instruments. And so that's the first hurdle. The second one is you need to get publicly listed. So that's the second. And then you have to work with your regulators in that market to deliver products like that. And each market's very different in terms of where they are, in terms of the rules and regulations. And really the job of a treasury company is to navigate that and to innovate and to be able to in compliance with the local regulations, deliver different Bitcoin-backed securities. So it's a lot of legal work, it's a lot of structuring, a lot of education to deliver those products. And each market's very different. And so I think you're seeing these different flavors of treasury companies, but you and I think it both would agree that like, every single company is going to fall into one of those buckets eventually as fiat currencies continue to be debased and people look for really just assets that outperform the rate of monetary debasement. I mean, that's really what we're talking about here. The traditional reserve assets underperform the rate of monetary debasement. Corporate treasurers and CFOs basically had to make this trade-off, which is basically, hey, I want liquidity. I want some price stability. And to do that, though, I'm going to lose value in real terms. And that's just how it is. And if I want to go out further on the risk curve and try to outperform the rate of monetary debasement, and basically I'm thinking like 6%, you got to go into more illiquid or riskier assets. And so, you know, kind of shifting the conversation to what Strategy is doing with Stretch is they're trying to combine that, the best of both worlds, where you have a liquid asset that outperforms the rate of monetary debasement that provides price stability. And so they're trying to create that short duration treasury asset in Stretch backed by Bitcoin. And that's really interesting, given the dynamics that I just mentioned that every single corporate treasurer faces. And so I think every single corporation or company is eventually going to adopt Bitcoin as a reserve asset, or Stretch as a reserve asset. But not many are going to go the route of Strategy and Strive. You know, that is going to be a company that's really focused on delivering those products to the market. That is their operating business, is deliver them, and they need a big Bitcoin balance sheet. And they need a level of conviction in Bitcoin, both from a price appreciation standpoint over the long term, and to build their entire business around that. Because, you know, Strategy, I don't think they get enough credit for the conviction they show by issuing the amount of Stretch that they have and having that dividend obligation. And they're saying, we just want the Bitcoin and we believe it's going to outperform that dividend rate over the long term because we have conviction in Bitcoin's adoption. And that's the business model.
You read my mind in that the next question I have was this idea of this evolution in the financing model. So just to backtrack about a couple of years ago, a Strategy, which was the first ever Bitcoin treasury company, kind of made waves because they issued these 0% coupon convertible debt, right? And then that's how they were financing their purchases. And then they were selling some common equity MSTR to finance more purchases as the NAV was multiples of one. That has shifted as of late, where Strategy has stopped issuing convertible debt and has now migrated to preferred equity, yield-paying preferred equity. And now we are at Stretch STRC, which is paying an annual dividend of 11.5%. And the bonds had a 0% coupon, meaning Michael didn't have to pay monthly interest to these people because the coupon was zero. He was just paying them the premium of the convertibility. But now, by issuing these prefs that have monthly dividend obligations, you're basically creating a need for cash to be paid out every month, cash that you have to generate from somewhere. So what do you think drove that evolution, and how do you see this business model evolving?
Yeah, so, you know, when you think about perpetual preferred equities like Stretch, for instance, and why they've pivoted their strategy to really focus on that as the ideal instrument, you just have to think about what they were doing before. So the converts, you're right, they usually come with a lower coupon because they do have that optionality to convert into equity. They got that upside. And so what Saylor was trying to do is, hey, I want long duration debt because Bitcoin is a long duration asset. And that minimizes the short-term volatility risk. If I could raise capital and not have to pay anything back, and maybe I won't ever because they'll just convert into equity because my equity will outperform. And, you know, that's pretty great still. I mean, that's really not a bad deal if you just believe that Bitcoin's going to appreciate over time. it just comes with a little bit of risk in terms of like, what if your equity doesn't outperform? You know, then you got to pay it back, right? So you got, there's a maturity. At the same time, what Saylor found was that the buyers of the convertible debt weren't necessarily aligned with the long-term strategy of the company. You know, they weren't believers in Bitcoin or MSTR. They just love volatility. And so the buyers of the converts or the people on the other side of that was typically hedge funds just harvesting volatility of the MSTR stock, which was highly volatile. And they would just turn around and short MSTR and just be basically neutral in that position, just basically harvesting the volatility. And so, yes, he would raise the money and the buy Bitcoin, but then they would turn around and short his stock, which would impact the premium and impact his ability to issue more equity, to buy more Bitcoin. So it just wasn't like ideal, right? It's like the they weren't like fully aligned. And that was the problem with the converts. So it was like the maturity risk as well as the buyers of those weren't aligned with the long-term strategy of the company. Now, the other thing you could have done is just a traditional, you know, loan, just like a Bitcoin secured loan or something like that. But that comes with, you know, it has a fixed maturity typically. There's repayment or refinancing risks. There's costs associated with refinancing. Oftentimes it can come with restrictive terms or covenants. And then Bitcoin short-term volatility can lead to like collateral requirements. I mean, you know all about this, right? And so, you know, you kind of, a perpetual preferred is like permanent capital. Like really the only thing that Saylor has to worry about is, can I service this dividend? You know, it doesn't have a maturity. He doesn't have to worry about refinancing risk. There's no restrictive covenants. You know, he doesn't have to encumber the Bitcoin. And that's really powerful because you're basically your liability is very long duration then. It's permanent. You know, he doesn't have to pay back the principal. And that matches the asset, which is a long duration asset. And on top of all of that is a preferred equity he can publicly list. And so it's really accessible to retail. When you raise capital via convertible or any traditional loan, each one is different. You know, each raise is different. You go to one hedge fund, they want different terms. It takes a decent amount of work. Whereas this, you can just like IPO and list it and retail investors can buy it. You know, there's usually gates for, you know, buying a convert. Like an individual doesn't do that. And so there's so many different benefits to why this instrument is the focus of strategy now for all those reasons. I mean, you could basically raise money in a way that is very accretive for shareholders when it comes to acquiring Bitcoin through raising capital through a perpetual preferred equity. Now, the one thing I'll say, and I think some people, you know, he's removing the maturity risk or refinancing risk and all those things that I talked about when he does that. But some people might look at this and be like, this is really expensive, you know, capital. It's, you know, he has to pay 11.5%. That's the cost, I think, of removing all those. And again, it goes back to the fact that Saylor thinks that Bitcoin over a long period of time is going to outperform that. You know, I think he said 21% over the next 21 years. And if that's really based on Bitcoin's historical performance over long periods of time. And crazy enough, it's kind of like, it's kind of low when you look at like rolling 5-year CAGRs and the different percentiles. And so he's saying, hey, I'll pay 11.5%, even though I could probably get a traditional loan that encumbers my Bitcoin and it's a little bit cheaper, but that comes with all those different risks. And so I don't want those. I just have to worry about paying the dividend. And the last thing I'll say, Mao, is like if he fails to pay it, it's different than failing to pay a coupon on a traditional loan where you're in default, you know, and you eventually have to go, there's a bankruptcy if you don't pay it. This is a dividend that's more flexible that as a company, he can stop paying. And typically if it's cumulative, he'll have to pay that back, the accumulated interest, if he suspends the dividend, but he's not going to go into bankruptcy. And so there's more flexibility too in terms of what he can do with the dividend. He can increase it, he can decrease it. It's just a much more flexible structure that provides the longest duration possible on the liability side to match the longest duration asset in history, as opposed to any traditional, debt instruments or credit instruments. So that's a long-winded answer, but that's
how I think. It's brilliant. And listen, I think, I've had a few people ask me already, it's like, why is Michael paying 11.5 for a CRC? Why didn't just borrow from Ledin? And I think you can borrow from single digits, right? Like now at a million plus, you can borrow single digits. And we do service some treasury companies, both private and public, but they don't have necessarily the same vision or access or ability to create some of these products that SDRC does or Strategy does. I know we're tight on time, and I do want to ask you one last question, which I think it's been in my mind, and I would love to hear your answer because I'm sure other people are feeling the same way I'm feeling, which is, I like what you're saying about Orange. I relate a lot to this, and I actually think there's a great economic opportunity around the strategy you guys are trying to execute on. Could you share a little bit, I guess in broad terms, what would be your value proposition for a non-Brazilian investor looking at Orange BTC? Like, presumably Brazilians understand that it is their local market. They're very attuned to the local opportunity and the size of that country. What would you say to somebody that's, like me, not in Brazil, looking at this, saying, I like what they got. I like their strategy. It sounds very sound. What's in it for me? Why should I get Orange BTC as opposed to another one?
Well, I think if you're an international investor looking at investing in Latin America, just understanding the industry landscape there and how much opportunity exists to build. I mean, we are differentiated in every single way just because we're listed in Brazil and we're operating in Latin America. And so there's different reasons why Orange BTC could do well over the coming years. I mean, it comes down to the management team and our ability to bring some of these products. I mean, if you look at the background of our management team, it's a lot of asset management. And so bringing different Bitcoin products to that market to improve access, I think we're the team to deliver that. And, when it comes to emerging markets and Brazil specifically, I think that if you look more broadly at the macro picture, I think we're in the midst of a rotation to emerging markets from the United States and developed markets. And really what it comes down to is this idea that the administration has said that one of their priorities is to onshore their industrial base, right? Bring the manufacturing back. But you need a weaker dollar regime to make the export economy more competitive in the United States. And they've said that they want a weak dollar. And it's partly that, it's partly our debt. They don't want a strong dollar. They want a weaker dollar. And in weak dollar regimes, historically, emerging economies do quite well. And I think Brazil is like a really interesting market right now. I mean, for so many different reasons. That's one of them. The other is just the amount of natural resources they have. I mean, I think molecules are being more valued right now, right? Like hard assets, natural resources. People are understanding that there's paper wealth and there's like real wealth. Brazil has incredible amount of natural resources and it's right in the Western Hemisphere. And I think you're going to see more trade with the United States, with Brazil. It's got the second largest rare earth minerals. And why I bring all this up is because I just think Brazil is really well positioned to have a good decade or two and really grow. And Orange BTC operating with Bitcoin as the largest Bitcoin public company is very well positioned to benefit from just that giant wave of capital as well as investment into Brazil and that region. And I think there's just not that much competition, to be honest with you. There's only three ways to get Bitcoin exposure in a publicly listed vehicle in all of Latin America. And we're one of them. And so when you compare that to the United States, there's probably 75 ways to get some kind of exposure to Bitcoin or the industry. And so like it goes back to what I said before, it's a couple of years behind the US in terms of Bitcoin adoption, Bitcoin understanding, but that provides a lot of opportunity. You know, if you're looking at a, you know, Bitcoin treasury company as a US investor or something like that, and you have this view that what I just talked about where, hey, I'm kind of bullish on emerging markets. Hey, I'm also bullish on Bitcoin. Well, Orange BTC is right there. And I think we have the management team to actually execute it and actually deliver the value for the shareholders. So, you know, that's kind of my general take, but I just, it's once you're in it too, you realize, you know, one of the value propositions of Orange BTC was the large financial institutions there are getting, they're seeing what's happening in the United States in terms of the adoption at the institutional level. And they're thinking, we want to get into that too. And we're talking to those, the largest banks in the region. And they're all interested that, you know, they're building. They want to partner on things. It's exactly what we thought about. So there's that component of the local large, and it's one of the largest banking industries in the world, Brazil. It's basically oil and gas and banking. That's finance, right? And we're kind of sitting there and we can be a partner because we're subject matter experts and have worked in Bitcoin financial services for years. And, you know, we're sitting there. And then there's also companies internationally who want to expand into Brazil because of the crypto adoption rates that I talked about and all these different dynamics. We're kind of sitting right in the middle there. And that was one of the value propositions that we said to investors early on was like, we think that we can be really well positioned. And we're seeing that bear fruit, you know, a few months after going public, like we're already seeing these things happen. And so very interesting market, you know, we're building heads down. Yeah, that's why Orange BTC for international investors could be an interesting value proposition.
I echo a lot of what you said. I do believe LATAM is going through its economic renaissance. I see it, and I've been saying this since Bukele won in El Salvador, since Milei won in Argentina. Now we have we've had a big political renaissance in most of LATAM. I know Brazil has elections this year. I know Colombia has elections this year. I'm hugely bullish in the region. I'm from the region. And the other thing that I love about Orange BTC is your team. I actually am good friends with Guy. I know Fernando well. You and I go back a while. And I think you guys have the right mix of Bitcoin, just Bitcoin knowledge, yet the ability to speak the language of large financial entities or large institutions. And I think that positions you guys very well for the future. Well, I could go on for longer, but we have to cap it. Otherwise, it's going to get way too long. And I want to bring you back once we have a few more months and see how the market has played out. But where can people stay or follow your work and follow Orange BTC? What's the ticker if anybody wants to buy it?
Yeah, so Orange BTC, you can go to orangebtc.com. We have a treasury dashboard. We can look at analytics. We have educational resources. And so you can just go to that website to learn more. You can follow me on X. I usually share analysis at Sam Calla, SamCallah. And there's also at Orange BTC on X as well, where we share company updates, Bitcoin education, all kinds of different things from that X handle as well. So that's where you can find more about us. And we're excited. I wish I could share a little bit more about what we're building right now, but it's a public company. I just can't. But I hope to have some exciting announcements in the next quarter or two. And I think that you'll be excited about it too, Mo.
Hell yeah. Well, we'll have you back to talk about those. And I hope to see you soon in the next conference, which I think is Vegas. I'm not sure if you're in Dallas later this week. I'm in Dallas too.
But, not in Dallas, but I will definitely see you in Vegas.
All right. We'll regroup then and I'll hope to learn more about what you've pushed from between now and then.
Yeah. Yeah, of course. Well, thanks for having me. I appreciate it. And let's talk again soon, okay?
My pleasure, man. See you soon. Among the many great points that Sam made during our conversation was that of the focus on a company's management team. At the end of the day, companies are just groups of people. If you have the right mix of people who are smart, principled, and committed in a team, magic happens. However, you can give the wrong group of people infinite resources and they'll still find a way to mess things up. Look no further than the country of Venezuela for that example. Latin America is a land full of opportunities for those who want to take the time to understand it and do things right. the potential to put Bitcoin front and center of a country and a region that is on the verge of a potential economic transformation is, in my opinion, a massive opportunity. At Ledin, we've always believed that Bitcoin should be easily accessible in the countries where people need it the most. Orange is making it easier for investors in Brazil to access Bitcoin. That's good for Brazilians, and that's good for the Bitcoin ecosystem. I hope you enjoyed our chat as much as I did, and we'll be back again soon with another great guest. If you enjoyed this Because of Bitcoin episode, I would be very grateful for the 5 seconds it would take you to drop us a review and give us a rating on your favorite podcasting platform. This will really help us reach even more listeners. And if you'd like to learn more about Bitcoin, be sure to check out our newsletter by subscribing at ledn.io. That's ledn.io. Again, this was Mauricio Di Bartolomeo. Stay tuned for our next episode. And until then, muchas gracias y los quiero mucho. Ciao, ciao.